Welcome to the Fireside Podcast, presented by the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. I'm your host, Chase Maxwell. Twenty-one years ago, the Friends began a storytelling series for adults. What could be better than sitting by the fire, sipping a hot cup of coffee or cider, while listening to some of the best writers Minnesota has to offer? Over the years, the Fireside series has featured a great range of authors, from Kate DiCamillo to Jack Weatherford, Carol Bly to Jack Elhigh, making the winter just that much more bearable. The 2015 lineup is no exception. Well, there actually is one exception, and you're listening to it. For over 20 years, the Fireside series has drawn enthusiastic crowds to the beautiful, but small, Hamlin Midway Library, and this is one way we're celebrating that legacy, by broadcasting the entire season and reaching a larger audience. Episode 3 features Wong Ping and James Lynn Festi, with a musical accompaniment by Master Zhang Ying and Nicholas Whitridge. Wong and Lynn Festi return to the Fireside series for an exploration of China through poetry, prose, and music. Wong's latest collection of poetry, 10,000 Waves, gives us the voices of Chinese farmers and factory laborers, revolutionaries, writers, artists, and craftsmen. Inspired by the work of a Tang Dynasty poet, Lynn Festi chronicles his trek to China's Han Shan, or Cold Mountain, to pay tribute to the writer who retreated there and took its name, in his new memoir, Seeking the Cave, A Pilgrimage to Cold Mountain. Wong is the award-winning author of several collections of poetry, essays, and works of fiction, and is a professor in the English department of McAllister College. Lynn Festi is a former journalist who has also written 4 collections of poetry and a book of personal essays. Lynn Festi is also a finalist in the Memoir and Creative Nonfiction category for the 27th Annual Minnesota Book Awards. So sit back, hopefully with a hot cup of cider in hand, and get ready to be transported.
What a joy to be in the room again with Master Zhang. What an honor. Thank you, sir. Poetry, you know, the Greeks had the 9 muses. 7 of them had to do with poetry and music. They're the closest brothers and sisters. They're not cousins. And music is a wonderful complement to these stories. I'm starting first because I start seeking the cave of the ancient poets. And Ping, in her marvelous new book from Wings Press, 10,000 Waves, talks about the living Chinese today and tells their stories. So Seeking the Cave is the story of a now 40-year love story, a love affair with a poet who lived in a cave in the Tiantai Mountains of China 1,200 years ago and may or may not have actually existed but changed my life. And so I'll read you just a taste of the prologue to give you a sense of how I launched myself on this journey in 2006 when I went to China to find this cave, and a little hint of why. And because of the way this works out today, I'll give you hints throughout of the arc of the story. So this is from the prologue.
Thank you.
Beginning sometime in my mid-50s, I developed a dream, a fantasy, really, I came to call Seeking the Cave. I'd see myself wandering the backcountry of China, seeking the actual cave of Cold Mountain, a poet who may never have existed, and if he did, is said to have disappeared into a crack in the mountain. And all I wanted to do was say thank you. Madness. And yet, in the fall of 2006, at age 62, there I was, climbing a stone stairway from the dusty trail below toward the open mouth of Cold Mountain Cave. Madness indeed. Men ask the way to Cold Mountain, wrote Han Shan, or Cold Mountain himself. Men ask the way to Cold Mountain. Cold Mountain, there is no through trail. This is the poet's journey. In my case, the trail was long and included many of the necessary joys and sorrows of a relatively educated, literate, fortunate American life. Now married 40 years, a grandfather, retired teacher, ad man, journalist, and poet since a boy, I saw the clouds of a busy life parked just long enough that I thought I could perceive the trail ahead. And so I stepped out. The summer before the scheduled mid-September departure, there arrived storms of trouble and confusion and doubt about this idea. One night, up alone, I heard a cricket singing outside the summer cabin door. I had never heard one there before in 20 years. I rose and went to the screen door and gently pulled it open. There he was, in his dark monk's robe. I took him in the palm of my hand. He had a song for me.
Thank you so much, and it's great to hear the turkey bones on. This is my first time. Thank you, Nick. And I just want to say something about this banner. 2011, I started this river project called Kingship of Rivers, and I got this idea at above 5,000 meters high in Tibet, and when I was putting some Minnesota, St. Paul Twin Cities, like five others work, and they were so insignificant by themselves. As soon as I placed them among millions of prayer flags on 5,000 meters high, the mountains, when the air was so thin, those five prints just immediately took on those millions of prayer flags power. And I just got a vision. I thought, my own work, my poetry, I've been working a lot along the Mississippi River and the Yangtze River, and I've been writing a lot about people and rivers and mountains. And I just thought, my own work has been insignificant, but if I join with these prayer flags, that means I'm joining much greater force. And also, it's no longer about me. It's about the rivers, and I can get all the people along the two rivers together to have them all sing poetry, create art, and imagine that power and the joy. So I started this Kingship of Rivers project, which brings the Mississippi and the Yangtze River together through music, poetry, art. And a lot of people here actually have been part of this. You know, Casey, you have made flags at the Soul Factory, and Jim made two beautiful flags, and Nick has done a lot, and Master Zhang has done a lot. Ron, you did, you made several flags. And Nina, I remember I started this project talking, having lunch in that the restaurant in Roseville, do you remember? And I talked with you too. Yes, yes. And the first flag actually was placed at Will Steger's headquarters in Ely. And this is the first flag banner made in St. Paul Public School, Horace Mann, okay, the fifth graders. And now we have over 2,000 flags. And those flags, 2,000 flags, were made by the people along the Mississippi River. I've been traveling back and forth along the Mississippi four times. And 2013, I took five people. We traveled along the Yangtze River with the 2,000 flags from the Mississippi River and with a musician. And that musician actually is going to, his album is winning the Grammy Award. So he is in LA doing the Grammy Award right now. So when we were there, the Chinese people, they were just in love. Wherever we went, when we hand the flags, right, and either the Mississippi people or the Yangtze River people, they just like faces and hearts just opened up and creativity just flew. And the Chinese people, they said, this is exactly what we wanted to do for many, many years, but couldn't. Thank you for bringing this to us. Right, and it was like guerrilla wars. We just open the flags, and the police will come, and we close it. We apologize, and we move on, just along the river until we reached the Mount Everest. And the Mount Everest was strictly controlled by police. And ironically, I couldn't get a permit because I was Chinese, and so my Tibetan guide. When we went to the checkpoint, there were three before we reached this, base camp. The Tibet, and then we have to go there because that's our final destination. My Tibetan guide turned to me in front of like a battalion of soldiers with machine guns guarding the checkpoint. He said, Ping, just walk. I said, you are crazy. He said, sometimes the most dangerous place is the safest place. And he said, you are protected by angels. So he just told me walk. And I just literally walked under those guards. You know, they are not just one or two. They are like rows and rows of soldiers at the checkpoints. And the road, there's no walking people, just me alone. And they could see me miles from the checkpoint. And so I went through like three of them. And I just thought, wow, somebody, some angels must have like blindfolded them for them not to see me. And I just kept thinking, when the bullet is coming at me. Because my son was in the car behind me watching, you know. But we went, we opened one flat, one, I think it's this one at the Mount Everest. So we're going again in May to Nepal side. So this time we're going to install everything overnight. Okay, so, and Dalai Lama actually heard of this project, and last year in April, he met with me privately, and I brought all these flags, and he personally blessed all these flags. You know, so this project has a lot of like magic, and you are all blessing this project, and so thank you. I'm going to read a poem. It's called about rare earth metal. It's about this farmer. I think the poem itself just is pretty clear. Rare earth in South China. First of all, it's not rare nor earth, as they call it. The metal lies under our feet, sparkling in the soil we farm. Red, green, yellow, blue, purple, sky of grass and buffaloes, patches of rice, bamboo, sweet yams. We came here as guests, Hakka, fleeing from angry lords. Year after year, we bent over the earth, feet and hand in the neon soil. Our sweat fertilized the fields, children, ancestors' graves. Our stove cooked the fragrance from the sun and moon. Now we dig deep in the mud, our boots rotting in the rainbow sludge. Dig and we dig, holes, pickaxes, guns, explosives, acid wash, 10 yuan a sack. This red dirt speckled with blue and yellow. Home, we cry, a small haven painted with green. Now the mountains are lifted, deep crates in the fields, blood and pus in streams and rivers. All because the world wants this earth, vitamins for iPods, plasma TVs, wind turbines, guided missiles, things that make the world cleaner and more beautiful, as they say. And here we are, in the waist-deep sludge, a sack of mud, a tale of greed, leeching in our stove. Fire licks my wife's slender hands, acid fumes in her lungs, liver, stomach, till she can no longer sip porridge laced with the thousand-year-old egg. In our cooking walks we exhume dysprosium, neodymium, promethium, all the names of gods they say. If gods have eyes, would they see us? Slaves on this earth, that no longer holds us. In the distance, a mushroom of dust, Boss and his Prius, powered by the sludge that chokes my eyes, ears, nose. One rich field, 25 pounds of metal, 10,000 sacks of earth, ripped from under our feet. We're slipping, our chests soaked in blood, backs broken, digging, pulling, no food or water. Our quota still short, the boss will be mad, but no matter. I light a cigarette, each puff is the last. Tomorrow is gone like our village. Here and far away, where horses ran wild, under the sky where we, children of Kinkaskan, return every night in our dream, which is gone too, they say. Mongolia, our origin, now a rare earth pit for the world. Oh, Hakka, Hakka, forever a guest, wandering on this bare earth.
Here we languish, a bunch of poor scholars ravaged by extremes of hunger and cold. Out of work, our only joy is poetry. And bless you for that. Scribble, scribble, we wear out our brains. Who will read the works of such men and women? On that point, ladies and gentlemen, you can save your sighs. We could inscribe our poems on biscuits, and homeless dogs wouldn't deign to nibble. Well, in 1974, running this insane hippie farm school in the mountains of Massachusetts, I would retreat to the bookstore for solace. But in the bookstore, the World Eye Bookshop in Greenfield, Massachusetts, the proprietor gave me a book. And the book was 100 poems called Cold Mountain, 100 poems by the Tang Dynasty poet Han Shan. And it changed my life, and I didn't know why. One of the reasons was that poem. And I think of it now as I was talking to some of Ping's McAllister students today. It's the most hopeful poem I know for anyone who wants to be an artist. That poem was written by a man who, if he isn't a myth, lived in a cave in the Tiantai Mountains of China 1,200 years ago. All we know of him is what's said in his poems. He had a wife once, and he rode a white horse. He had a wife and a child once, and rode a white horse, which is like driving a Porsche convertible these days, so it was a big deal. And he went and did battle in the capital to get a job and pass the civil service exams and to get a job like everybody else who was of the educated class in China. In the Tang Dynasty, was the 6th to 9th century. Well, but we don't know why, but he ended up living in a cave alone. No wife, no child, no Porsche convertible, and going to visit his friends, his two friends that were known. He had one, a kitchen helper in the Guoqing Temple, and another, a monk, Feng Kang, in the Guoqing Temple. And I love that voice. Why is that poem hopeful? Because there's a guy, despairing. He painted this on a wall, on the wall of a temple, or on the wall of a house, or carved it on a piece of bamboo. And what do we know today? I'm reciting it to you by heart. Who knows when you put a piece of art, when you put a prayer flag out in the world, who and when and where it will touch. So this book is about that story of me being touched by that voice. So I also learned right away. So I put together a trip in 2006 and went to China and went to a variety of places, visiting a variety of the great poets of the Tang and Sung dynasties. I'll give you a little taste of that. But on the way, we stopped in Tokyo. And we did because it turns out I don't speak Chinese at all, not one word. So even though I'm not exactly bright, over the 30 years of contemplating why this voice so touched me, I realized that it wasn't, in fact, his voice. It was his voice through a mediator, his translator, Dr. Burton Watson, who was the translator of that particular collection, which I still recommend by far as the highest. It's called Cold Mountain, translated by Burton Watson, by Columbia University Press. Came out in 1970. My copy was 1974. And I still carry it with me, and I lose everything, if those of you who know me, but I haven't ever lost this. This is my scripture. Well, so on the way, we went to Tokyo and interviewed Dr. Burton Watson. The story of that interview is here, and I won't tell you that, except I'll give you the way the story ends after the interview. The Zosuji Temple Gate, the original, constructed in 1613, is engraved with text translated on a nearby plaque. Gate for getting delivered from earthly states of mind, greed, anger, and stupidity. Burton Watson passed through that gate many years ago, I thought. Much stupidity remains ahead for me, and probably greed and anger too. But my visit with him felt like an important step to begin to shed the husk of this world. Like the cicadas whose freshly minted bodies sang throughout the long Tokyo night. Basho said, "Nothing in the cry of cicadas suggests they are about to die." Sad at Watson's departure, I felt a burst of happiness too. His vocation, translator, so often lay buried behind the original author's more prominent name. Yet my life had been affected by his life's work, and I had been able to tell him so. The voice ringing in my ears these 30 years, dissolving time and space, was his. Encounter with the arch translator. He reads Cold Mountain's poems slowly, eyes swimming in the ocean of his father's gaze. His warm tones soar like a Pacific breeze over two continents, 3,000 years and one timeless practice, sitting still, making poems. He is as loud as one hand clapping, awake as a slap in the face, radiant as his original face, a bug escaped from a bowl, tears wet as a river longing for its home in the sea.
I will read a poem about trying my bargain skill I learned in America, in China. You know, it's in China, it's just like everything you have to haggle. Then you got carried away. Bargain. This is a pair of handmade shoes. Awkward and lovely, like the maiden behind the stand. Gold phoenix bloom unabashed on red corduroy tops. White soles are made of layered cloth, pasted on the door with flower. A slow air dry in the moonlight, stitches lined up neatly, like terracotta soldiers on battleground. This is a pair of shoes I've been seeking for years. The craft my grandma tried to pass on before I left home for good. Without trying them on, I know they would comfort my calloused feet soles. Let me run like a whirlwind, make me feel like a sword drawn out of its sheath. And we start a bargain. 10, she says, for the sake of fate that brought you to this desert town. 5, I say without thinking, a trick from my American partner. Good joke, big sister, she laughs, deep creases flashing across her frostbitten face. I blush for no reason. 6, then, I say, avoiding her hands that bring back grandma. In her flickering shadow on the wall, threading a needle, come on, sister, have some respect. Okay, 7, can't go up anymore. Respect has to be mutual, don't you think? Barely enough to pay for the materials, sis. Her voice low, wet like the drizzle. No mercy, I repeat the mantra drilled into my brain. Peddlers are good at arousing sympathies. That's how they make a living. 8, then, the highest I can offer. You peasants are getting greedier day by day. She raises her hands, 10 knotted roots, 10 question marks of childhood and wisdom. Do you know how many nights I stayed up to stitch the soles? Do you see my fingers? Do you see my eyes? See my little brother waiting for a bowl of noodles my shoes could buy. His hunger does not lie. My callous does not lie. We do not lie. I walk. I'm not practicing the walk-away tactic that works like magic. I'm running from the mirror of her eyes. Stubborn girl, I murmur to myself. It's just a game, just a game. She chases, thrust the shoes into my hands. You won, miss, take them for nine. What's 9 yuan to you? $1.20? And what's a yuan? Less than a dime? Would you even bother to pick it up from the street? I put away my victory in the trunk, never give it a second thought, until I'm pulled out of the line at Minneapolis Custom, maggot fingers prodding socks, underwear, wrapped gifts. And there it is, my bargain, red and loud like thunderclaps. You saved a dime, fool, but lost your soul. Thank you.
So off to China. And we visited the graves and the sites of many of the great thinkers and poets of the ancient Chinese world. We went to Confucius's birthplace. We celebrated with him his 2,557th birthday, a number that boggles the mind of Americans, but is routine in the Chinese. We visited the site of the great poet Da Su Deng Po, who wrote this poem and survived it. This poem, which I learned from the great Bill Holm, some of you remember him well, I hope, one of the great Icelandic heroes of modern life, and now sadly deceased. But Bill taught me this poem at a reading at the Minneapolis Public Library probably 30 years ago. I heard him and said, send me that poem. And Su Deng Po, the great calligrapher, poet, and writer of the and public administrator of the Song Dynasty, 9th and 12th century, wrote, on the birth of his son. Families, when a child is born, hope it to be intelligent. I, through intelligence, having wrecked my whole life, only hope the child will be born ignorant and stupid. Then he will crown a tranquil life by becoming a cabinet minister. Well, the first great surprise was to discover the grave of Zha Dao, a poet that I had never heard of, but his story is a great story, and I'll tell you a little bit about it. Because if you're a painter, you're in love with light. If you're a sculptor or a potter, you're in love with touch. And if you're a poet, you're in love with sound. Here's his story. So this is the story of Zha Dao's fortunate accident. After abandoning a monk's life for that of a poor poet in the world, he was traveling on his donkey one day, absorbed in the bottomless problem of choosing the exact word sound to fit a poem. Should it be knock or push in the line, in moonlight, a monk knocks or pushes the gate? As he rode, lost in thought, his donkey stumbled into the sedan chair of a high official, spilling him to the ground. Fortunately, that official was Han Yu, Confucian poet and teacher, as well as important public administrator. So instead of cutting off Zha Dao's head for such careless effrontery, you recognize that such absorption in the problem of sound and sense was the mark of a true poet. Instead of cutting off his head, he gave him friendship. Here in distant China, in a small town, in a small township near Beijing, I was awakened to one more poet seeking ancient friendships between sounds. It's a line from Robert Bly. Chinese culture has absorbed Zha Dao's lesson well. According to his best translator, Mike O'Connor, the compound push-knock became thereafter the traditional term to describe not only Zha Dao's assiduousness of craft, but any poet's exacting labor to find the mot juste or make careful stylistic distinctions. I was on the right trail.
Zha Dao, Jia Dao is a wonderful poet. Well, Chinese call him Gui Cai, the ghost talent. And he died very young. And his poetry is full of spirits and ghosts, but they are brilliant. And Chris, you will like his work, you know. And you will like his work. I have quite a few McAllister projects in writing, the senior capstone students. And they are our future, and future writers and future poets. And I feel very fortunate to teach at McAllister. I've never had a bad student. I've never had a bad class. So thank you. Just a joy every time. 16 years. And my colleague, Casey. And I just love my colleagues and students at Mac. Very fortunate. And also thank you, Elaine. And you have been just such a big support all the time. Thank you. So I'm going to read Dust Angel. This is actually the first poem for this book. When I learned in China, there are about 300, there have been like 300 million peasants poured into the coastline and cities to make products for the world. And they left everyone behind. So often the whole village was empty except children and older people. And this song actually I used the form from the Book of Songs, which is like being accumulated, sung by Chinese people 5,000 or 6,000 years ago. Then Confucius put them together and made the first poetry anthology. It's called Book of Songs. And Jim, you talked about the Book of Songs, how the translation by Ezra Pound and Arthur Whaley, and later, you know, there are more modern translators, and they actually really changed the Western poetry. And ironically, it was Ezra Pound's little book of essays called Chinese Character as a bridge to poetry, like opened my eyes to the wonder of Chinese ideograms, Chinese language. Chinese language is not alphabet, it's not linear, it's actually like Lego parts. You can make infinite different things with those Lego parts. So, and it's three-dimensional almost, okay? And so it's very visual, and usually, according to, you know, Ezra Pound believed Chinese character has the words has direct connection with objects. Okay, like the sun, Ri, shaped like the sun, the moon shaped like the hand, Shou shaped like a hand, you know, and so. And it really opened, Ezra Pound opened my eyes to poetry and the sound for poetry, right? And I did not know I have that treasure until I read Ezra Pound. And then at the same time, through the Chinese poetry, Ezra Pound opened the eyes and revolutionized, you know, the Western poetics. So again, it's a kingship of poetics, I would say, and kingship of rivers. Everything is connected. Dust angels, stars, diamonds, tears of hearts, sand and cut and sand, shrouded in silicon fog, we string beauty with corn husking hands. Bracelets, necklace rings, day and night, night and day. We bend over screeching wheels, making trinkets for USA. Saints, Buddha, gods, rush down the belt at a dizzying speed. A quarter cent apiece, the price of our hands, a nation's pride, a civilization eating us alive. Opal, malachite, topaz, stones from the deep, so cheap at Walmart. Our lungs harden from quartz crystal, our lives weigh less than dust. We cough and wheeze walking half a block. We gasp for air. They say we fake our sickness, have never worked in their factories. They hire lawyers to erase our names, ban our union. Marx and Mao are history, they claim. Only freedom of market economy, the golden path towards democracy. No money to go home, no face to see parents, wives, husbands, children. All bridges collapsed. We loiter in hospitals, courts. We pray not to die in this strange land. Dust angels, who wears the stars and hearts strung with tears? Who makes a fortune from our wretched breath? Who will see us of all the Buddha and saints carved out of our bodies? All the eyes of Mary and Jesus painted in our blood. The last line refers to the only part of those little religious figurine has to be painted, the eyes have to be painted by hand. That's because the Western custom markets, the clients, they're very particular about the expression and tears in Mary's eyes.
I'm going to read bits from three different chapters. So I mentioned we visit. So the two great philosophers in the Chinese tradition, Confucius, and China will always be a Confucian culture. It's all about being organized, and this is the culture that's waxing the world today, as we know, because it's super organized and super attention to how we relate to each other. And Confucius, of course, came up with this idea because he looked back in the chaos of the earlier ages and tried to come up with a system that will operate in the real world in his day, a series of filial piety, and that world still operates in China. But there is another voice, Lao Tzu. And we also went to the place where Lao Tzu famously, the other great philosopher, he who hears the ear of nature and says, that's the call, not the organizations of society. We went there. I'll just read you a little bit of the end of this chapter and a couple little bits of two others together in the middle as we get toward the end. So we visited the place. This is up near Xi'an, the western capital. We drove for 11 days from Beijing to Xi'an in the far west, the ancient capital of the Silk Road. 2 million people living there at the time of the Silk Road. Incredible city. That's like traversing from Minneapolis to Denver across, weaving across the Great Plains. On those 11 days, we never saw the sun. But we get to Xi'an and we get to this cut, which is this natural cut in the low soil, this very powdery soil, which is the secret to the ancient Chinese success as a civilization. It's a soil that's so soft, it's like face powder, that you can plow it with a wooden stick. And for 3,000 years, they have tremendous productive agriculture has been able to plow this stuff. So as we stood between the walls of compressed dust rising over our heads on both sides, I recall that tear in the fabric of my generation, repeated again and as mindlessly by the war in Iraq. I imagine the guard himself. So the background of that is that Lao Tzu turned his back on the endlessly warring bureaucracy from the capital. He moved out of Washington and he moved to the mountains. I imagine the guard himself, war-torn and weary, now bored and lonely, stopping at old man's mysterious passage. Why west? Why alone? Why toward nothingness? Please, sir, sit down. Teach me what you know. I have a brush. I have ink. We have time. We will write it down together. The desert above us is boundless. The cities behind us war without end. Your bones can wait a few more days to disappear into dust. It is said the guard may have recognized Lao Tzu as a revered teacher, once keeper of the archives at Luoyang. Some say Lao Tzu was 88 years old, others 160, others 996. Maybe he was 62. We know only that he lived long enough to have something eternal to say. Thus, the world gained the Tao Te Ching, 5,000 words about what cannot be expressed in words. The Tao that can be told is not the eternal Tao. The name that can be named is not the eternal name. The nameless is the beginning of heaven and earth. The named is the mother of 10,000 things. Nearby, visiting school children climbed a high battlement and shouted their delight to companions below. I kept my journal and my pen in my backpack. What could I possibly say? And then this, because this is the modern China that we drove through, condensed into a paragraph. On the road from Beijing to Xi'an, we often passed coal-fired power plants, hurtling clots of dense gray smoke, sometimes accompanied by cumulus clouds of steam boiling up from massive wasp waste cooling towers. I had heard there were many nuclear power plants in China, and of course the epic Three Gorges hydroelectric dam, and some dramatic new solar and wind installations, but all we ever saw were angry coal-fired dragons belching crude smoke, the kind that America tamed to the Clean Air Act more than 30 years ago. Thanks to electricity, life is easier for humans living on China's agricultural plain, but breathing is harder, much harder. As for the natural life of the planet, only heartbreak.
Thank you.
I will read a poem about Tibet, what has been changing. The first time I went to Tibet was 1994, after I had a big fight with Allen Ginsberg. Not my fault, actually. I was doing the translation for him and for him and the Chinese poets, Bei Dao. And they started arguing about what is going on in Tibet, and suddenly Allen Ginsberg yelled at me, said, "What the F do you know about Tibet?" And just like saliva spitting all over. And I just said, "Allen, I'm translating for you. Why are you yelling at me?" And so he realized and walked away and came back with a pile of his rare books, and he drew Buddha on each of them, and stars and lotus, and he said, my apology for yelling for Buddha. And that made me decide I'm going to Tibet and check it out. And the minute I landed in Tibet, and I just felt at home. So I've been back, and actually this idea, river flags, was borrowed from Tibet prayer flag idea, but at the same time, this whole Kingship River project was really for Tibet. And at that time, the first time, I've been going back to Tibet many times. I've been to Mount Everest 3 times. And it really changed my whole mindset, because you have to start learning how to walk and how to breathe. Okay, you have to start from there, because the air is so high. And also my next realization was nobody could conquer Tibet. Nobody. Not guns or soldiers. But then when the Tibetan railroad opened up in Tibet, across Tibet land, I realized it's over. And this poem is called Solstice in Tibet, in Lhasa. What more can you say, nomad daughter of glaciers? The city has bleached the sun from your face. 18 years old with a freckled nose, hides of yak, barley, sanding wind, knees stiff from scrubbing toilets. What dreams keep you alive on the marble floor of Gongka Hotel? Drunken tourists and their nightingales. Money is the moon on Lhasa's holy streets. In Beijing, a storm drops 36 tons of dust upon the city of concrete. Nomad daughter from the Black River, what more can you say? The wetland is becoming a desert, home for rats, carcass of yaks. The salted tea you brought to me in my room, yellow butter afloat from a distant factory. It's fake, but tastes okay. The real is gone, like the snow caps. Wind breath, naked riverbeds. At dusk, a boy on a motorcycle comes home with his last hurt. Nomad daughter from the sacred lake, what dreams keep you going in the glass cage of illusion? Before the clouds, cabs, trucks, mobs of fortune seekers. Behind the clouds, Patola Palace, absent of its Buddha. Your ancestors are on the road, nomad daughter from the Blue Treasure Plateau. Wooden gloves and padded knees, long prostrations into the thin air. Their cry of never perish ghosts, calling you to keep the lamp burning, burning. And you shout to me across the street, sister, please find me a rich husband in America.
We turned back. So we went from Siam, we took the train back to Nanjing, and then went through the Yangtze River, where we visited, on the way to the Cold Mountain, we visited the site where one of the two greatest poets of the Tang, Li Bai, is said to have died by drunkenly embracing the shadow of the moon in the Yangtze River. It's a wonderful myth, because who doesn't love the idea of someone being in love with his virtual lover? I was happy to be visiting one of the Tang's most celebrated poets at the site where he famously drowned in the Yangtze, attempting to embrace the reflection of the moon. The story is literary mythology, of course, but who doesn't love a poet's ecstatic desire for his metaphoric lover? His most famous moonstruck poem is recited all over China to this day, Thoughts on a Quiet Night. Before my bed, the light so bright, like a layer of frost. Lifting my head, I gaze at the moon. Lying back down, I dwell on home. Li Bai's seemingly effortless poetic musicality through form, rhyme, and tonal play is music impossible to translate, and therefore music I will never hear. I thought of a moon poem written by a young American friend of mine, Thorsten Bacon, whose ear captures American moon music, perhaps the way Li Bai sings to Chinese ears. A love poem. Moon, moon, our sound for deliciousness. Married with ooh, our sound for awe. Ending in such contentment, the sound we make falling back into the pillows again. I recited to Knowing Laughter lines written by Sam Hamill, sent to me years ago by poet Chase Twitchell on the art of literary translation. Squabbling as they will in busy traffic, two crows make meals of roadkill. Seems to me, I added, that coming to China to translate poetry is like going to Saudi Arabia to drill for oil. There's an inexhaustible pool waiting to be brought to the surface, and when it arrives, it changes everything, including the infrastructure of one's own voice. It certainly has changed mine, and that from only a chance encounter with Cold Mountain. Through Burton Watson and Gary Snyder, Pound, Bly, Wright, Merwin, all their voices were changed. And isn't Letter to Tomasito Tom McGrath's Chinese-inflected voice? We relaxed into the remaining drive in silence, and as we did, I sang my own moon song, moon music. The moon laughs or cries, who really knows? Old Li Bai knows, as if a golden gong, his golden song rings from the singing arc of ancient heaven. Mother of months, mother of tides, mother of fertile blood and moonstruck mating, drunk on your shining, Li Bai sings in tones of golden gongs I cannot hear, and so I sing this slow, sad, sibilant song.
You've been listening to the Fireside Podcast, presented by the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. The next episode will feature comedian and author Lorna Landvik. Please consider subscribing to this podcast on iTunes. Until then, we hope you consider supporting the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library and its mission, stronger libraries for stronger communities. Learn more at thefriends.org. Follow us on Twitter at The Friends and on Facebook at facebook.com/friendsofSPPL.